Keeper or Thorned Namshiel. But I'll take any of those guys in a foot race. Guaranteed. I run. And not so that I'll be skinny and look good, either. I run so that when something that wants to kill me is chasing me, I'll be good at running. And when you got legs as long as mine, you're skinny and in good shape, you can really move. I hit the woods running like a deer, sticking to the path we'd broken on the way up. The snow made it easy to see the way, and though in another hour or two it would be a sheet of frozen ice, for the moment the footing was excellent. I was benefiting from the chaos caused by guards' entrance. I could hear all kinds of confusion as men shouted in the woods and tried to figure out what was going on, to get the wounded to help, and to follow what were probably conflicting orders thanks to holes ripped in their chain of command by Hendricks and his minigun. Radios clicked and voices buzzed over them, functioning unreliably, as they would in any area so rich with concentrated magical energy. The fact that most of the men had had their tongues removed probably didn't help anything either. Nick should have taken my advice and read that evil overlord list. Seriously. Someone a few yards off to my right shouted something at me. It came out as totally mangled gobbledygook. I shouted back at him in similar wordless garbage, pretending that I didn't have a tongue either, and added a rude gesture to the tirade. I don't know if it was the perfect charade, or if it just shocked him into stunned silence, but either way it got the same effect. I went on by him without garnering any further reaction whatsoever. I thought I was home free as I reached the ruins of the little company town and its one main drag along the shoreline. And then I heard Magog's bellow coming down the hill behind me, coming fast, too, easily making twice the speed I could manage. That was the damnedest thing about these demonic collaborator types. Even though they didn't work out and practice, they still got to run faster than we dedicated roadsters who actually sweated and strained for our ability to haul ass. Jerks. It seemed clear that Magog was coming in pursuit of me, or at least that he was coming down the hill toward the dock and the boat off the island to cut off any chance of escape. I had little time to pick and choose where to go to avoid his notice, and wound up ducking into the long, heavily shadowed, cavernous length of the building that looked as if it had once been a cannery. The roof had fallen through in several places, and snow covered perhaps a third of the floor, providing the only thing even vaguely like light. Most of the walls were still standing, but I had grave doubts about the floor. There wasn't space for much of a basement above the waterline, but there was plenty of room to break a leg if I fell through on a weak board. I would just have to stay close to the wall and hope for the best. For once, enemy manpower was working in my favor. If Nicodemus had brought only his fellow Denarians along, there would have been nothing but the footprints of cloven hoofs and giant mantises and grape apes and whatnot in the snow of the island. But no. He'd had to bring along dozens and dozens of foot soldiers, too, and as a result, there were regular old footprints everywhere. One more set, more or less, wasn't going to stand out. So all I had to do was get into the building, get out of sight, and lie low until Magog had gone past. I had no sooner crouched down and begun my impersonation of a mouse than the ancient, half-rotted wood of the old cannery shuddered beneath me, a vibration that I felt in the soles of my feet. Then another. And another, rhythmic, like slow footsteps. They were followed by the sound of Magog's approach, a heavy, leathery shuffling through the snow, accompanied by the steady heave of lungs like a blacksmith's bellows. Then I heard Magog slide to a sudden halt in the snow and snort in surprise, then let out an enormous roar of challenge. And a voice, a very deep, resonant voice, said,
"Be thou gone from this place, creature. My quarrel is not with thee."
Magog answered with a howl and spat out words in a language I did not understand.
"Be that as it may, Elder One," the huge voice said, gently and with respect. "I also have a duty from which I may not waver. We need not be at odds this night. Depart in peace, Elder One, with your beast of burden." Magog snarled again in that foreign tongue. The deep voice hardened. "I seek no quarrel with thee, fallen one. I prithee, do not mistake peaceable intention for weakness. I do not fear thee. Begone, or I will smite thee down." The deep voice hardened. I seek no quarrel with thee, fallen one. I pray thee, do not mistake peaceable intention for weakness. I do not fear thee. Be gone, or I will smite thee down.
The gorilla-like Denarian howled. I heard its claws dig and rip at the ground as it hurtled forward toward the source of the resonant voice. Magog, it seemed, had a really limited vocabulary when it came to repartee. I couldn't see what happened next. There was a flash of gold-green light, like sunlight reflected from fresh spring grass, and a detonation in the air. A sound that was not quite a crack of thunder, not quite an explosion of fire. It wasn't even loud so much as it was pervasive, something that I felt along the whole surface of my body as much as I did on my eardrums. The wall of the cannery shattered inward, and Magog, what was left of Magog, came hurtling through it. It landed on the ground about 20 feet away from me. Enormous sections were missing from the front of the gorilla-like body, including its thighs and most of the front half of its torso. It wasn't a messy wound, either. The empty chunks were limbed with a gentle yellow-green glow that seemed to seal in any blood. Even as I watched, Magog quivered once and went limp. Tiny sprouts of green flowered up from the fallen corpse over the course of a couple of seconds, leaves spreading, then budding out into wildflowers in a riot of colors. The coating of flowering plants seemed to devour the body of the gorilla from around the mortal body beneath, that of a muscular young man, which gradually emerged, though was still modestly shrouded in a veil of flowers. He was thoroughly dead, his eyes glassy, empty, and there were flowers growing in a hole where his heart had been. He wore a leather collar, and hanging from it, in a little rubber frame, like a dog tag, was another blackened denarius. He was a kid, Molly's age at the oldest. From outside there was a deep, resonant sigh, then another heavy ground-shuddering thump, and another, coming closer. My heart jumped right up into my teeth. Sure, I had no idea who that really was out there, but all those these just screamed that it was one of the she. They really got into the archaic modes of speech, or maybe it was fairer to say that they never got out of them. Anyway, odds were running high that this was eldest brother Gruff, come to settle up with Winter's champion in this affair, and given that he'd just swatted down one of the Denarians like he was an uppity pixie, it didn't bode real well for me. I found myself taking a step back as that thumping sound came again, and the floorboard beneath my foot creaked precariously. That gave me an idea. The bigger they are, etc. If Eldest Gruff was even bigger than the last one had been, maybe I could use the rickety flooring against him long enough to get myself out to the boat and off the island in any case. Open water was another fantastic neutralizer for the enormous size discrepancy. Setting realistic goals has always been the key to my success. I didn't have to win a fight with this thing. I just had to survive long enough to run away. I took a chance, picked the most solid-looking floorboard I could see, and eased across the floor to the far side of the building, the one nearest the water, and turned to face the hole in the wall that Magog's body had smashed open on its way in. Thump, thump, thump. I readied my will and shook out my shield bracelet in case I needed it. I lifted my staff and pointed it at where I thought Eldest Gruff's head might be when he came in so he would know I was serious. Thump, thump, thump. I adjusted the aim on the staff a little higher. Thump, thump. Sweat trickled off my brow. Thump, thump. How far did this guy have to walk? Thump, thump. This is just getting ridiculous now. Thump, thump. And Eldest Gruff appeared in the opening. He was 5 feet tall. 5'2", tops. He wore a robe with a cowl pulled back so that I could clearly see his curling ram's horns, the goat-like features, the long white beard, the yellow eyes with their hourglass pupils. And in his right hand, he carried a wooden staff, carved with runes that looked almost precisely like my own. He took a limping step forward, leaning on his staff, and when he planted the tool on the ground, it flickered with green light that then splashed out onto the earth beneath it, spreading outward in a resonating wave. Thump! The floorboards creaked beneath him, and he came to a cautious stop and faced me quietly, both hands on his staff. His robe was belted with an old bit of simple rope. There were three stoles hanging through it, purple ones, faded and frayed with the passage of time. Those were the mantles worn by members of the Senior Council, the leaders of the White Council of Wizards. They were, generally speaking, the oldest and strongest wizards on the planet. And eldest brother Gruff had, evidently, killed three of them in duels. "This," I said, "has really not been my day." The Gruff regarded me solemnly. "Hail, young wizard." He had a deep, resonant voice, far too huge and rich for the frame it came from. "Thou knowest why I have come." "To slay me, most likely," I said. "Aye," said the Gruff, "by my queen's command and in defense of Summer's honor." "Why?" I asked him. "Why would Summer want Marcone taken by the Denarians? Why would Summer want the Archive under their control?" The Gruff only stared at me for a long moment, but when he spoke, I could have sworn that his voice sounded pensive, maybe even troubled.
"It is not my place to know such things, or to ask."
"The Gruffs are Summer's champion in this matter, aren't they?" I demanded. "If not you, then who?"
"What of thee, wizard?" the Gruff countered. "Hast thou asked why the wicked Queen of Winter would wish thee to prevent Marcone from being taken by those servants of the darkest shadow? Why she, who embodies destruction and death, would wish to protect and preserve the Archive?"
"I have, actually," I said.
"And what answers hast thou found?"
"Gruff," I said, "I find myself largely clueless about why mortal women do what they do. It will take a wiser man than me to understand what's in a fey woman's mind."
Eldest Gruff stared at me blankly for a second. Then he threw back his head and made a sound that, well, more than anything, it sounded like a donkey. "Hee-haw! Hee-haw! Hee-haw!"
He was laughing. I laughed, too. I couldn't help it. The whole day had just been too much, and the laugh just felt too good. I laughed until my stomach hurt, and when the Gruff saw me laughing, it only made him laugh harder, and more like a donkey, and that set me off in turn. It was a good 2 or 3 minutes before we settled down. "They tell children stories about you guys, you know," I said.
"Still?" he said.
I nodded. "Stories about clever little billy goats outsmarting big mean trolls until their bigger, stronger brothers come along and put the trolls in their place." The Gruff grunted. He said,
"We hear tales of thee, young wizard."
I blinked. "You, huh?"
"We too like stories about—"
he searched his memory for a moment before he smiled, pleased. The gesture looked pleasantly nonviolent on his face.
"Underdogs."
I snorted. "Well, I guess this is another one." The Gruff's smile faded.
"I dislike being cast as the troll."
"So change the role," I said. The Gruff shook his head.
"That I cannot do. I serve Summer. I serve my queen."
"But it's over," I said. "Marcone is already free, so's Ivy."
"But thou art still here, upon the field of conflict," the Gruff said gently. "As am I, and so the matter is not closed. And so I must fulfill my obligations, to my great regret, wizard. I have only admiration for thee, in a personal sense."
I tilted my head and stared hard at him. "You say that you serve Summer and the Queen, in that order?" The Gruff mirrored my gesture, his eyes questioning. I fumbled in my pocket and came out with the other thing I had grabbed back at my apartment, the little silver oak leaf pen Mister had been batting all over Little Chicago. I'd figured that they'd stopped using it to chase me once they'd gotten tired of Mister having his catnipped way with them. The Gruff's eyes widened. "The confounding enchantment thou didst employ upon our tracking spell was most efficacious.
I had hoped to ask thee how it was done. Trade secret, I said. But you know what came with this pin.
Indeed, he said. You were made an esquire of summer and granted a boon, but...
He shook his head.
A boon can be a matter of importance, but not one this grave. Thou canst not ask me to yield to thee in a matter of conflict between the courts themselves.
I won't, I said. But just so we're clear, once both of us have left this island, the matter is closed.
Once thou art safe again in Chicago, aye, it would be.
Then I ask for summer to honor its pledge to me, and the debt it incurred to me when I struck at Winter's heart on its behalf.
The gruff's ears stood up facing me.
Aye? I want you, I said, to get me a donut. A real, genuine Chicago donut. Not some glamour donut, an actual one, freshly made.
The gruff's teeth began to show as he smiled again.
Of course, I said. You could deny me the boon I rightfully earned in blood and fire and kill me instead, thus ensuring that Summer would renege on a debt and never be able to make good on it. But I don't think that would be very good for Summer and its honor.
Do you? Indeed not, wizard, the gruff said. Indeed, it would not be. He bowed his head to me. Likest thou jelly within thy donut?
Nay, but prithee with sprinkles upon it instead, I said solemnly, and frosting of white.
It could take some time to locate such a pastry, the gruff said seriously.
I bowed my head to him. I trust in the honor of Summer's champions that it will arrive in good time.
He bowed his head in reply. Understand, young wizard, I may not aid thee further.
You're pushing the rules enough already, I said dryly. Believe me, I know how that is.
Eldest Gruff's golden eyes glittered. Then he lifted the staff and thumped it quietly onto the floorboards. Once again, there was a pulse of green light and a surge of gentle thunder, and he was simply gone. So was the silver oak leaf pin. Just gone from my fingers, and I hadn't felt a thing.
Give it up for the Fae. They can do disappearing like nobody's business. Maybe I should have taken some lessons. It might have helped me get out of this mess alive.
I made my way carefully back across the creaking floor to the body of the young man. He looked relaxed in death, peaceful. I had the impression that whatever Eldest Gruff had done to him, it had been painless. It seemed like the sort of thing the old fairy would do. I reached down with my gloved left hand and grasped the tag containing the blackened denarius of Magog. I jerked it sharply, pulling it off the collar, and pocketed it, careful not to let it touch skin. I was getting to be kind of blasé about handling these coins, but it was difficult to keep getting terrified over and over again, especially given the circumstances. The risk of once more exposing my immortal soul to a fiendish presence seemed only a moderate danger compared to what still stalked the night outside the old building. Speaking of which, I took a deep breath and made my way quietly back out to the street. I could still hear shouting from farther up the hillside. I heard the sound of a boat's engine on the far side of the island. There must have been other vessels docked elsewhere along the shore. Well, I'd known about only the one, and it was close. I slipped back out of the cannery and hurried down the street as quickly and quietly as I could. Down past the bottom of the rough stone staircase, the boat still floated, tied beside the broken stump of an old wooden column. I restrained the urge to let out a whoop and settled for hustling down the frozen stones as fast as I could without breaking my neck. The water was viciously cold, but I still wasn't feeling it, which probably wasn't a good thing. There was going to be hell to pay in afterthought pain when this was over. But compared to the other problems I'd had recently, that one was a joy to think about. I got to the boat, tossed my staff in, and clambered aboard. I heard a shout up the hillside and froze. A flashlight swept back and forth up in the trees, but then moved off in another direction. I hadn't been seen. I grinned like a fool and crept up to the driver's seat. Once I got the engine started, it would attract attention, but all I had to do was drive west as fast as I could until I hit ground. The whole western shoreline hereabouts was heavily occupied, and it should be no problem to get to a spot public enough to avoid any further molestation.
I eased into the driver's seat and reached for the ignition key. But it was gone. I felt around for it. Rosanna had left it in the ignition. I specifically remembered that she had done so. The shadows rippled away from the passenger seat opposite the driver's seat, revealing Nicodemus. He sat calmly in his black silk shirt and dark trousers, the gray noose worn like a tie around his throat, a naked sword across his lap, his left elbow resting on his left knee. In the fingertips of his left hand, he held a key ring, dangling the grease-smeared ignition key of the boat.
"Good evening, Dresden," he said. "Looking for this?"
Chapter 45. The sleet had stopped coming down, in favor of large, wet flakes of snow again. The boat rocked gently on the troubled waters of the lake. Water slapped against the sides and gurgled around the curve of the hull. Ice had begun to form all along the sides and the front of the boat. I think there are boat words for all the pieces that were being covered, like prow and gunwale, but I'm only vaguely aware of them.
"Harry Dresden, speechless," Nicodemus said. "I can't imagine this happens every day." I just stared at him. "In the event that you hadn't worked it out for yourself yet," Nicodemus said, "this is endgame, Dresden."
The fingers of his right hand stroked the hilt of his sword.
"Can you puzzle out the next part, or must I explain it to you?"
"You want the coins, the sword, the girl, the money, and the keys to the Monte Carlo," I said. "Or you shoot me and drop me over the side."
"Something like that," he said. "The coins, Dresden."
I reached into the pocket of my duster and...
"What the hell?" I said.
The Crown Royal bag was gone. I checked my other pockets, careful of the coin I'd taken from Magog, and careful not to reveal its presence to Nicodemus. No bag. "It's gone."
"Dresden, don't even try such a pathetic lie on me."
"It's gone," I told him, with considerable heat, none of it feigned. 11 coins. 11 freaking cursed coins. The last time I remember definitely having them had been up at the tower when I jingled them for Nicodemus. He stared at me for a moment, his eyes searching, and then murmured something under his breath. Whispers rolled from the shadows around him. I didn't recognize the language, but I did recognize the tone. I wondered if the angelic tongue had swear words, or if they just said nice words backwards or something.
"Doog, Tews, Doog."
Nicodemus's sword came up as swiftly as a flickering snake's tongue and came to rest against my throat. I didn't have time to flinch, it was that fast. I sucked in a quick breath and held very, very still.
"These marks," he murmured. "Thorned Namshiel's strangler spell."
His eyes drew a line from the last apparent mark on my neck down to the duster pocket that the bag of coins had been in.
"Ah, the strangulation was the distraction. He picked your pocket with one of the other wires before he was incapacitated. He did that to Saint someone or other in Glasgow in the 13th century. There's nothing like getting taken with an old trick, I guess. But that meant that Namshiel had been working together with someone else. Someone else who had to have been hanging around to collect the coins after he'd taken them from my pocket and tossed them off to the side in the confusion. Someone who hadn't been pulling a fade after all."
"Tessa and Rosanna," I said quietly. "They got their collection of thugs back. They bailed at just the right moment to ruin your plan, too."
"Deceitful bitches," Nicodemus murmured. "One of them is our own Judas. I was sure of it."
I lifted my eyebrows.
"What?"
"That's why I let them handle the more, shall we say, memorable aspects of the Archive's initiation to our world," Nicodemus said.
"I suppose now that the child is free, she'll have some rather unpleasant associations with those two."
"And you're telling me this why?"
He shrugged a shoulder.
"It's somewhat ironic, Dresden, that I can talk to you about this particular aspect of family business. You're the only one that I'm sure hasn't gone over to this new force, this Black Council of yours."
"How can you be so sure about me?" I asked him.
"Please,"
No one so obstreperous has ever been corrupted by anything but his own pure mule-headedness. Nicodemus shook his head, never taking his eyes off me. Still, my time here has not been wasted. The knights carried away Namshiel's coin, so Tessa has lost her sorcery teacher. I heard Magog's bellow end quite abruptly a few moments ago, just before you walked out of the same building, so, with any luck, Tessa's heaviest bruiser is out of the game for a time as well, eh? Nicodemus smiled cheerily at me. Perhaps his collar is in one of your pockets, and I have Phidlacius. Removal of one of the three is profit enough for one operation, even if I did lose this chance at gaining control of the archive.
What makes you think, I said, that you have Phidlacius?
I told you, Nicodemus said. This is endgame. No more playing. The pitch and intonation of his voice changed, and though he still spoke in my direction, it was clear that he was no longer speaking to me.
Shadow, if you would, disable Dresden. We'll talk some sense into him later, in a quieter setting.
He was talking to Lashiel's shadow. Hell, wizards didn't have a monopoly on arrogance. Neither did the Knights of the Cross. I stiffened in place, my mouth half open. Then I fell over sideways, body resting against the boat's steering wheel, my spine ramrod straight. I didn't move, not one little twitch. Nicodemus sighed and shook his head.
Dresden, I truly regret this necessity, but time is growing short. I must act, and your talents could prove useful. You'll see. Once we've cleared some of these well-intentioned idiots out of our way, he reached for Phidlacius.
And I punched him in the neck. Then I seized the noose and jerked it tight. I hung on, pulling it tighter. The noose, another leftover from Judas's field, made Nicodemus more or less invulnerable to harm from everything but itself. Nicodemus had worn the thing for centuries. As far as I knew, I was the only one who had worked out how to hurt him. I was the only one who had truly terrified him. He met my eyes for a panicked second.
Lashiel's shadow, I told him, doesn't live here anymore. The fallen have no power over me, and neither do you.
I jerked the noose a little tighter. Nicodemus would have screamed if he could have. He thrashed, uselessly, reaching for his sword. I kicked it out of reach. He reached up and raked at my eyes, but I hunched my head down and hung on, and his motions were more panicked than practiced. His shadow rose up in a wave of darkness and fury, but as it plunged down to engulf me, white light shone forth from the slits in the wooden cane sheath of the holy sword on my back, and the shadow itself let out a hissing, leathery scream, flinching away from the light. I was no knight, but the sword did for me what it had always done for them. It leveled the field, stripping away all the supernatural trappings and leaving only a struggle of mind versus mind and will versus will, one man against another. Nicodemus and I fought for the sword and our lives. He threw savage kicks into my wounded leg, and even through the blocks Lash had taught me to build, I felt them. I had a great handle on his neck, so in reply, I slammed my forehead against Nicodemus's nose. It broke with really satisfying crunching sounds. He hammered punches into my short ribs, and he knew how to make them hurt. Unfortunately for him, I knew how to be hurt. I knew how to be hurt with the best of them. It was going to take a whole hell of a lot more pain than this loser could dish out in the time he had left to put me down, and I knew it. I knew it. I tightened my grip on that ancient rope, and I hung on. I took more blows to the body as his face turned red. He got one of my knees with a vicious kick as his face turned purple. I was screaming with the pain of it when the purple started looking more like black, and he collapsed, body loosening, and then going completely limp. A lot of people let up when that happens, when their opponent drops unconscious, but it could have been a trick. Even if it hadn't been, I'd been planning to hang on. I'm not a knight. In fact, I squeezed harder. I wasn't sure how much longer I'd had him down. Might have been 30 seconds, might have been a minute and a half. But I saw a flash of furious green light and looked up to see Deidre
coming down the hillside toward me on her hair and three limbs, one leg bound up in white bandages. She had 20 or 30 tongueless soldier types with her, and her glowing eyes burned with verdant fury like a pair of spotlights. She focused on me for half a second, hissed like a furious alley cat, and screamed,
"Father!"
Crap. I grabbed Nicodemus by the shirt and pitched him over the side, into the black waters of the lake. He went down with hardly a splash, his dark clothing making him all but invisible an instant after he hit the water. I scanned the bottom of the boat frantically. There, the key. I scooped it up and jammed it into the ignition.
"Don't shoot!"
Deidre screamed.
"You might hit my father!"
She bounded into the air, all that writhing hair folding back into a single, shark-like swimming tail as she dove and hit the water with barely a splash. I turned the key. The old boat's engine coughed and wheezed. "Come on," I breathed. "Come on." If I didn't get this boat moving before Deidre found her daddy, game over. She'd order her soldiers to open fire. I'd have to raise a shield to stop the bullets, and once I did that, the already wonky engine would sure as hell never get moving. I'd be stuck, and it would only be a matter of time before a combination of weariness, mounting pain, numbers of attackers, and wrathful daughter took me down. Deidre surfaced, cast a glance around to orient herself, and dove into the featureless darkness again. The engine caught, and then turned over drunkenly.
"Booyah!"
I screamed. Then I remembered that I hadn't untied the boat. I lunged awkwardly up to the front and untied the rope, very much aware of all the guns pointing at me. The boat came free. I pushed off the pole, and the vessel began to sluggishly turn. I hobbled back to the steering wheel, cranked it around, and gave the engine some power. The boat throbbed and then roared and began to gather speed. Deirdre surfaced maybe 20 feet in front of me, carrying her father. Before she even looked around, she screamed,
"Kill him! Shoot him! Shoot him!"
Cheerfully, I swerved the boat right at her. Something thumped hard against the hull. I hoped for some kind of lawnmower-like sound from the propellers, but I didn't get one. Gunfire erupted from the shore, meanwhile, and it wasn't blinded by bright lights or hurried or panicked. It started ripping the boat to splinters all around me. I started shouting curse words and crouched down. Bullets hit my duster. For several seconds, the range was pretty close, at least for the military-grade weapons they were using. And while the duster was up to the chore of stopping those rounds, it wasn't any fun to experience. My back got hit with half a dozen major league fastballs over the next few seconds, and cold water washed over my feet, and half a minute later over my ankles. Double crap. The engines were making really odd noises. My back protested when I turned to look. It was damn dark out there on the lake as I got farther and farther from shore, but the disappearing form of the island was being blotted by a lot of black smoke coming out of the boat's engine. The pain blocks were falling now. I was hurting a lot. The water in the bottom of the boat was up to the bottom of my calves now, and there were 3 searchlights coming toward me from the direction of the island. They'd sent out pursuit boats. "This just isn't fair," I muttered to myself. I gave the engine all the power I could, but from the way it was rattling around, that was more or less a formality. It wasn't going to last long, and it was sinking in any case. I knew that if I went into the water, I'd have about 4 or 5 minutes to live, given the temperature. I also knew that I had to get past the stone reefs around the islands, the ones Rosanna had needed the beacon light to navigate through. Nothing for it but to keep going. I was struck by a sudden thought. Bob the Skull was going to be crushed that he missed this one, a genuine pirate adventure. I started singing, "Blow the Man Down," at the top of my lungs. Then there was a horrible noise, and the boat just stopped. The steering wheel hit me in the chest pretty hard, and then I bounced back into the driver's seat. Water started pouring in thick and fast and dark.
"Ahoy!"
I slurred drunkenly.
"Reef!"
I made sure I still had the coin and the sword. I grabbed at my staff and got out the pinnacle amulet from around my neck. The lights of the pursuing boats were getting nearer by the moment. This was going to be a close one. The old ski boat was literally breaking apart around me, its prow shattered on a thick spike of stone that had penetrated it just left of its center up by the front of the boat.
The old stone ridge that rose up through the waters of the lake came to within a couple of feet of the surface here. It would give me a place to do something besides instantly immerse myself in cold water and go into hypothermia. And it would give me solid rock on which to plant my feet and through which to draw power. The water of the lake would wash some of it away, not as much as free-running water, but some. But I would still be able to do something to defend myself. So before the boat could capsize and dump me into the water, I gritted my teeth and jumped in. My body immediately informed me that I had made an insane decision. You have no idea what the depths of cold can be until you've jumped into near freezing water. I screamed my way into it, finding places to stand with my frozen feet, being careful of the leg that Nicodemus had rendered gimpy for me. Then I held up my mother's amulet in my right hand and focused on it, forcing energy into it, carefully and slowly. It happened sluggishly, the way everything was happening in the mounting cold. But I was able to draw power up through the stone beneath my feet, and to call silver-blue wizard light from the amulet, brighter and brighter, light that spread out over the waters in a literal beacon that read clear as day, "Here I am." "Thomas," I muttered to myself, shivering so hard I could barely stand. "You'd better be close." Because Deirdre's men were. The searchlights oriented on me instantly, and the boats, rubber raft things that would skim right over the reefs, came bouncing toward me over the waves. It wouldn't have been impossible to sink one of the rafts, but it would have killed every man inside, and those weren't people collaborating with demons for their own dark gain. They were just people, most of whom had been brought up from childhood to serve Nicodemus and company, and who probably thought that they were genuinely doing the right thing. I could kill someone like Nicodemus and sleep peacefully afterward, but I wasn't sure I could live with myself if I sent those rafts down into the lake and condemned the men in them to die. That isn't what magic is for. More to the point, killing them wouldn't save me. Even if I managed to sink every other raft out there, send every man in them into the water, it wouldn't stop me from freezing to death and drowning. It would just mean that I had a lot of company. I'm not a knight, but that doesn't mean I don't draw the line somewhere. They started shooting from about 100 yards away, and I raised a shield. It was hard to do in the icy waters, but I raised it and held it, a shimmering quarter dome of silver light. Bullets smashed against it and skipped off it, sending out little concentric rings of spreading energy as their force was distributed over the shield. Most of the shots never really came anywhere close. Shooting from a moving rubber raft at 100 yards isn't exactly a recipe for precision marksmanship. They got closer, and I got colder. I held the light and the shield. "Please, brother, don't let me down." I never heard anything until a wave of cold water hit my shoulder blades and all but knocked me over. Then the heavy chug-chug-chug of the water beetle's engines shook the water around me as my brother's battered old ship bellied up dangerously close to the reef, and I turned to find the ship wallowing broadside behind me. I liked to give Thomas a hard time about the water beetle, teasing him that he'd stolen it from the prop room of Jaws, but the fact of the matter was that I didn't know a damn thing about boats, and that I was secretly impressed that he could sail the thing around the lake so blithely. "Harry!" Murphy called. She came hurrying down the frozen deck, slipping here and there on patches of ice as she did. She slapped a line attached to a harness she wore to the ship's safety railing and threw the other end of the line to me. "Come on!" "It's about time you got outside the reef," Thomas complained from the top of the wheelhouse. As I watched, he drew his heavy Desert Eagle from his side, aimed, and loosed a round. A dark form on one of the oncoming rafts let out a cry and fell into the water with a splash. I scowled at Thomas. "He doesn't even practice." I stumbled forward and grabbed the line, wrapping it around my right arm. That was pretty much all I had enough energy left to do. Murphy began hauling it in and started yelling for Thomas to help her.
"Cover me!"
Thomas yelled. He came down from the wheelhouse pirate style, just jumping down, all graceful and stylish despite the roll of the ship, despite the ice and the cold. Murphy, her feet planted, secured to the railing, shifted her grip and produced a little assault weapon she had on a strap around her back. A P-90 Kincaid had given her as a gift. She raised it to her shoulder sighted through the scope at one of the oncoming rafts, and started calmly squeezing out rounds, one and two at a time.
Fam, 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 fam.
One of the rafts foundered. Maybe she'd struck whoever was steering it and caused him to misguide it. Maybe the lake had simply swamped it, I don't know. But a second raft immediately turned to start picking up men who had spilled into the water from the first. Murphy turned her gun onto the remaining raft. Thomas started hauling me out of the water by the line around my arm, just pulling me up arm over arm as if I'd been a child and not an adult 100 pounds heavier than him. He doesn't even work out. I was tired enough that I just let him do it. As a result, I had enough spare attention to notice when my feet cleared the water and Deirdre surged out of the blackness and seized my ankles.
Kill you!
She snarled.
Kill you for what you did to him! Holy crap!
Thomas yelled.
Ack!
I agreed. Most of those deadly strands of her hair were thrust into the stone reef below, holding her down. But a few that were free whipped wildly at Thomas. He ducked aside with a yell, barely managing to hold on to the line. It felt like she was going to pull my legs off at the ankle. I screamed and kicked at her as best I could, but my legs were so numb that I could barely move them, much less shake her off. Thomas had all that he could do to simply hold on to the line and prevent those bladed strands from severing it.
Karen!
He screamed. Murphy swung her legs up over the railing of the ship, still attached to it by the line fastened to her harness. Then she swung herself out into empty air above the water until she hung alongside me. Then she aimed the P-90 down at Deirdre and flicked the selector to full automatic. But before she could pull the trigger, Deirdre hissed, and a flickering blade swept up and struck Murphy across the face. She screamed and recoiled as the blade continued, an S-shaped cut that missed Murphy's throat by a finger's breadth, and sliced through the strap that held the P-90 on her body. The weapon tumbled into the water.
Bitch!
Murphy snarled, one side of her face a sheet of blood. She tried to reach for her pistol in its shoulder holster beneath her harness, beneath her coat. It might as well have been on the surface of the moon.
Murph!
I said. I twisted my shoulders and thrust the end of Phidolachius to within reach of her hand. Murphy's fingers closed on the hilt of the holy blade. She drew it maybe an inch from the scabbard. White light blinded me, blinded Deirdre, blinded Murphy, blinded Thomas, blinded everyone.
No!
Deirdre screamed, utter despair and terror in her voice.
No, no, no!
The pressure on my ankles vanished, and I heard the Denarian splash into the water. Murphy released the hilt of the sword. The light died. It took maybe half a minute before I could see anything else. Thomas recovered faster, of course, and by that time, he had us both back onto the deck of the water beetle. There was no evidence of Deirdre anywhere, and the two boatloads of soldier boys were hightailing it away as fast as they could go. Murphy, bleeding from a cut running parallel to her right eyebrow, all the way into her hairline, was staring in shock at me and at the sword. What the fuck was that? I slipped the sword off my shoulder. I felt really tired. I hurt everywhere.
Offhand? I mumbled. I'd say it was a job offer.
We've got to move before we get carried onto the reef, Thomas muttered. He hurried off pirate style. He looked good doing it, of course. He doesn't even moisturize. Murphy stared at the sword for a second more. Then she looked at me, and her bloody face went tight with concern.
Jesus, Harry.
She moved to the side of my wounded leg and helped support my weight as I hobbled into the ship's cabin.
Come on, let's get you warmed up.
Well, I asked her as she helped me.
How about it? I've got this sword that needs somebody to use it.
She sat me down on one of the bench seats in the ship's cabin. She looked at the sword for a moment, seriously. Then she shook her head and said quietly, I've got a job. I smiled faintly and closed my eyes.
I thought you'd say that.
Shut up, Harry.
Okay, I said.
And I did. 4 hours. It was glorious. Chapter 46. I woke up covered in a couple of heavy down comforters and innumerable blankets,
and it was morning. The bench seat on the water beetle had been folded out into a reasonably comfortable cot. A kerosene heater was burning on the other side of the cabin. It wasn't exactly toasty, but it made the cabin warm enough to steam up the windows. I came to slowly, aching in every joint, muscle, and limb. The after-action hangover was every bit as bad as I had anticipated. I tried to remind myself that this was a deliriously joyous problem to deal with, all things considered. I wasn't being a very good sport about it, though. I growled and complained bitterly, and eventually worked up enough nerve to sit up and get out from under the covers. I went to the tiny bathroom, though on a boat I guess it's called a head for some stupid reason, and by the time my zombie shuffled out, Thomas had come down from the deck and slipped inside. He was putting a cell phone back into his jacket pocket, and his expression was serious. "Harry," he said, "how you doing?" I suggested what he could do with his reproductive organs. He arched an eyebrow at me. "Better than I'd expected." I grunted. Then I added, "Thank you." He snorted. That was all. "Come on. I've got coffee for you in the car." "I'm leaving everything to you and my will," I said. "Cool. Next time I leave you in the water." I pulled my coat on with a groan. "Almost wish you had." "Coin? Sword?" "Safe. Stowed below. You want them?" I shook my head. "Keep them here for now." I followed him out to the truck, gimping on my bad knee. I noted that someone had, at some point in the evening, cleaned me up a bit and put new bandages on my leg, and on a number of scrapes and contusions I didn't even remember getting. I was wearing fresh clothing, too. Thomas. He didn't say anything about it, and neither did I. It's a brother thing. We got into the battered Hummer, and I seized a paper cup of coffee waiting for me next to a brown paper bag. I grabbed the coffee, dumped in a lot of sugar and creamer, stirred it for a quarter turn of the stick, and started sipping. Then I checked out the bag. Donut. I assaulted it. Thomas began to start the car, but froze in place and blinked at the donut. "Hey," he said, "where the hell did that come from?" I took another bite. Cake donut. White frosting, sprinkles, still warm, and I had hot coffee to go with it. Pure heaven. I gave my brother a cryptic look and just took another bite. "Christ," he muttered, starting the truck. "You don't even explain the little things, do you?" "It's like a drug," I said through a mouthful of fattening goodness. I enjoyed the donut while I could, letting it fully occupy all my senses. After I'd finished it and the coffee started kicking in, I realized why I'd indulged myself so completely. It was likely to be the last bit of pleasure I was going to feel for a while. Thomas hadn't said a damn thing about where we were going, or how anyone was doing after the events of the night before. The Stroger Building, the new hospital that has replaced the old Cook County complex as Chicago's nerve center of medicine, is only a few yards away from the old clump of buildings. It looks kind of like a castle. If you scrunch up your eyes a little, you can almost imagine its features as medieval ramparts and towers and crenellation standing like some ancient mountain bastion, determined to defend the citizens of Chicago against the plagues and evils of the world. Provided they have enough medical coverage, of course. I finished the coffee and thought to myself that I might have been feeling a little pessimistic. Thomas led me up to intensive care. He stopped in the hallway outside. "Lucio's coordinating the information, so I don't have many details, but Molly's in there. She'll have the rest of them for you." "What do you know?" I asked him. "Michael's in bad shape," he said. "Still in surgery, last I heard. They're waiting for him up here. I guess the bullets all came up from underneath him, and that armor he was wearing actually kept one of them in. Bounced around inside him, like a BB inside a tin can." I winced. "They said he only got hit by 2 or 3 rounds," Thomas continued, "but that it was more or less a miracle that he survived at all. They don't know if he's going to make it. Sonya didn't go into anything more specific than that." I closed my eyes. "Look," Thomas said, "I'm not exactly welcome around here right now, but I'll stay if you need me to." Thomas wasn't telling me the whole truth. My brother wasn't comfortable in hospitals, and I was pretty sure I'd figured out why. They were full of the sick, the injured, and the elderly, the kind of herd animals that predators' instincts told him were weakest and the easiest targets. My brother didn't like being reminded about that part of his nature. He might hate that it happened, but his instincts would react regardless of what he wanted or didn't want. It would be torture for him to hang around here. No, I said, I'll be fine. He frowned at me. All right, he said after a moment. You've got my number. Call me, I'll give you a ride home. Thanks. He put a hand on my arm for a second, then turned, hunched his shoulders, bowed his head so that his hair fell to hide most of his face, and walked quickly away. I went into the intensive care ward and found the waiting area. Molly was sitting inside, next to Charity. Mother and daughter sat side by side, holding hands. They looked strained and weary. Charity was wearing jeans and one of Michael's flannel shirts. Her hair was pulled back into a ponytail, and she didn't have any makeup on. She'd been pulled from her bed in the middle of the night to rush to the hospital. Her eyes were focused into the distance and blank. Small wonder. This was her greatest nightmare come to life. They looked up as I came in, and their expressions were exactly the same. Neutral, distant, numb. Harry, Molly said, her voice hollow, ghostly. Hey, kid, I said. It took Charity a moment to react to my arrival. She focused her eyes on the far wall, blinked them a couple of times, and then focused them on me. She nodded and didn't speak. I said quietly. Molly raised her hand to stop me from speaking. I shut up. Okay, she said. Let me think. She closed her eyes, frowning in concentration, and started ticking off one finger with each sentence. Lucio says that the archive is stable but unconscious. She's at Murphy's house and needs to talk to you. Murphy says to tell you her face will be fine. Sonia says that he needs to talk to you alone and as soon as possible at St. Mary's. I waved a hand at all of that. I'll take care of it later. How's your dad? Severe trauma to his liver, Charity said, her voice toneless. One of his kidneys was damaged too badly to be saved. One of his lungs collapsed. There's damage to his spine. One of his ribs was fractured into multiple pieces. His pelvis was broken in two places. His jaw was shattered. Subdural hematoma. There was trauma all through one ocular cavity. They aren't sure if he'll lose the eye or not. There might also be brain damage. They don't know yet. Her eyes overflowed and focused into the distance again. There was trauma to his heart, fragments of broken bone in it, from his ribs. She shuddered and closed her eyes. His heart. They hurt his heart. Molly sat back down beside her mother and put her arm around Charity's shoulders. Charity leaned against her, eyes still spilling tears, but she never made a sound. I am not a knight. I'm not a hero either. Heroes keep their promises. Molly, I said quietly, I'm sorry. She looked up at me and her lips started quivering. She shook her head and said, Oh, Harry. I'll go, I said. Charity's face snapped up and she said, her voice suddenly very clear and distinct, No. Molly blinked at her mother. Charity stood up, her face blotched with tears, creased with strain, her eyes sunken with fatigue and worry. She stared at me for a long moment and then said, Families stay, Harry. She lifted her chin, sudden and fierce pride briefly driving out the grief in her eyes. He would stay for you. My vision got a little blurry, and I sat down in the nearest chair. Probably just a reaction to all the strain of the past couple of days. Yeah, I said, my throat thick. He would. I called everyone on the list Molly had quoted me and told them they could wait to see me until we knew about Michael. Except for Murph, they all got upset about that. I told them they could go to hell and hung up on them. Then I settled in with Molly and Charity and waited. Hospital waits are bad ones. The fact that they happen to pretty much all of us sooner or later doesn't make them any less hideous. They're always just a little bit too cold. It always smells just a little bit too sharp and clean. It's always quiet, so quiet that you can hear the fluorescent lights, another constant, these lights, humming. Pretty much everyone else there is in the same bad predicament you are, and there isn't much in the way of cheerful conversation. And there's always a clock in sight. The clock has superpowers. It always seems to move too slowly. Look up at it, and it will tell you the time. Look up an hour and a half later, and it will tell you 2 minutes have gone by. Yet it somehow, simultaneously, has the ability to remind you of how short life is, to make you acutely aware of how little time someone you love might have remaining to them. A day crawled by. A doctor came to see Charity twice to tell her that things were still bad and that they were still working. The second visit came around supper time, and the doc suggested that she get some food if she could, that they should know something more definite after the next procedure, in 3 or 4 hours. He asked if Charity knew whether or not Michael had agreed to be an organ donor. Just in case, he said. They hadn't been able to find his driver's license. I could tell that Charity wanted to tell the doctor where he could shove his question and just how far it could go, but she told him what Michael would have told him. Yes, of course he had. The doctor thanked her and left. I walked down to the cafeteria with Charity and Molly, but I didn't feel like eating or having food urged upon me. I figured that Charity probably had a critical back pressure of mothering built up after this much time away from her kids. On the way, I claimed that I needed to stretch my legs, which was the truth. Sometimes when there's too much going on in my head, it helps to walk around a bit. So, I walked down hallways, going nowhere in particular, just being careful not to pass too near any equipment that might be busy keeping someone alive at the moment. I wound up sitting down in the hospital chapel. It was the usual for such a place. Quiet, subdued colors and lights, bench seating with an aisle in the middle and a podium up at the front, the standard layout for the services of any number of faiths. Maybe it leaned a little harder toward Catholicism than most, but that might have been only natural. The Jesuits actually had a chaplaincy in residence and held mass there regularly. It was quiet, which was the important thing. I sank onto a pew, aching, and closed my eyes. Lots of details chased their way around my head. Michael had come in with gunshot wounds. The cops were going to ask lots of questions about that. Depending on the circumstances of the helicopter's return to Chicago, that could get really complicated really fast. On the other hand, given the depth of Marcone's involvement, the problems might just vanish. He had his fingers in so many pies in Chicago's city government that he could probably have any inquiry quashed if he really wanted it done. Given what he'd been saved from, it would be consistent with his character for Marcone to repay the people who bailed him out with whatever aid he could render in turn. It irked me that Marcone could ever be in a position to offer significant aid to Michael, regardless of the circumstances. Of course, for that to happen, Michael would first need to survive. My thoughts kept coming full circle back to that. Would he be in danger right now if I hadn't insisted that he put on that harness? If I hadn't shoved him under that rope ahead of me, would he still be up there under the knife, dying? Could I really have been that arrogant to assume, based on one glance at Guard's face, that I not only knew the future, but had the wisdom and the right to decide what that future should be? Maybe it should be me up there. I didn't have a wife and a family waiting for me to come home. I'd expected Charity to scream and throw things at me. Maybe I even wanted that, because while I intellectually understood that I had no way of knowing what was going to happen, and that I'd only been trying to protect my friend, a big part of me couldn't help but feel that I deserved Charity's fury. After all, it reasoned, I'd gotten her husband killed as surely as if I'd murdered him myself. Except that he wasn't dead yet, and thinking like that was too much like giving up on him. I couldn't do that. I looked up at the podium, where whoever would presumably be when someone was there delivering the sermon. I know that we don't talk much, I said, speaking out loud to the empty room. And I'm not looking for a pen pal, but I thought you should know that Michael makes you look pretty good, and if after all he's done, it ends like this for him, I'd think less of you. He deserves better. I think you should make sure he gets it. If you want to bill it to me, I'm fine with that. It's no problem. Nobody said anything back.
And while we're on the subject, I said, I think the rules you've got set up suck. You don't get involved as much as you used to, apparently.